Okay, I think we can get started. I just want to thank the Sandra Welkis and Kenny Wintman, who are sponsoring today's shiur in memory of the Yortzeit, the 24th Yortzeit, Bo Bayom today, on Yud Dalet Av, of their father, Avraham Tzvi ben Yitzchak Chaim. Should have long life, and the Neshama should have an Aliyah, and it's sort of I don't know. In many ways, their mother's Yortzeit is in 4 days, but in the same week, their parents passed away in the same week. So often that shows a tremendous bond, I think, between husband and wife. But anyways, you should have good memories, and we should all have happy occasions to come together. Thank you. Okay, Dr. Sokolow. Hey,
Rabbi Kelman, this is Judy Sokolow. If I could just say to Sandy, we have a little bit of history, and we haven't been in touch for a while. This is such a nice way to reconnect with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Okay. Bakasha, doctor.
Okay. Okay. So, just to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago, we had begun to look at another of Rambam's rather lengthy letters. Monograph would probably be a better rendition in this case of Igeret than a letter. The one that he composed and wrote to the leader of the Jewish community of Yemen, in response to a kind of a concatenation of several significant problems that were besetting Yemenite Jewry towards the end of the 12th century. One was the standard. We've already made reference to that in the opening classes, and that was a constant pressure on the part of Muslim authorities on Jews to convert. And the other was kind of more internal than external, and that was the appearance in Yemen of several messianic pretenders. And the last class that we had, we looked at several of those false messianic movements that beset Yemenite Jewry at that period of time, and to which Rambam referred specifically in his letter. Today, we're going to look at a corollary of false messianism, and that is the kind question of messianic calculations, otherwise known as millenarianism, from the idea of the millennium, the idea that somehow when you reach a certain mark on the calendar, something significant, if not apocalyptic, is going to happen. You might just think back not really more than just 20 years or so to the anxiety that preceded what has come to be known as Y2K, that somehow on the stroke of midnight of December 31st, 1999, the transition into the new millennium was going to cause all sorts of havoc in technology and things like that. So these things do occur from time to time. Hence, as you see, I've entitled this millenarianism, that is anticipation of the end, and messianic calculations. And the subtitle is borrowed from a line in the Talmud. In the tractate Sanhedrin, the Talmud says, Tipach atzman shel mechashevei kitzin, that may the bones of those who calculate the end be blasted. Obviously, if you're dead, you're not really going to know what happens to your bones. But since the Jewish tradition pays respect even to bones, the idea that somehow the bones would be broken or pulverized is certainly not something that anybody would welcome. Now, notice, by the way, the source. This is from the Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin. And it says, Daf Tzadi Zayin Amud Bet, that is to say, page 97, folio B. Keep that in mind as we move to the next slide, which, as you can see, comes from the same source, Masechet Sanhedrin, the same tractate. In fact, even the same page, Sadi Zayin, 97. However, it comes from Amud Aleph, the previous folio. So the line, the excerpt that we saw in the previous slide, the one that condemns the bones of those who calculate the end to being pulverized, is actually a follow-up to this source. This is a well-known source, Tanad Ve'Eliyahu. Not particularly sure if anybody really knows what that is, whether this Eliyahu is a reference to Elijah the prophet or whether there actually was a Tana by the name of Eliyahu. We occasionally hear about Devei Rabbi Yishmael, Devei Rabbi Akiva, schools that were either actually literally schools that were begun by significant rabbinic figures or people who followed in the traditions of those figures were somehow referred to as being the school of so-and-so. So just as there was a school of Rabbi Akiva and a school of Rabbi Yishmael, there could very well have been a Tana named Eliyahu, and this again would be referring to his students. As I said, the alternative is somehow that this is a reference to the prophet Eliyahu. And if that's the case, of course, it lends some additional significance to this, because the prophet Eliyahu, as you remember, and this is actually biblical and not rabbinic, it's the closing verses in of the last of the books of the prophets, the book of Malachi, in which the prophet says in God's name, Hine anochi shole'ach lachem et Eliyahu hanavi lifnei vo yom Hashem hagadol v'hanora. That the day of the Lord, the awesome and terrible day of the Lord, arguably the apocalypse, is going to be preceded by the arrival of Elijah the prophet. So if indeed this statement, which is, as we'll see in a moment, somehow alludes to the end of days, is actually attributed not to a Tanaitic figure named Eliyahu, but somehow is imputed to the prophet Eliyahu, then of course, it, as I said, it adds significance to it. In either case, here's what the source says. Sheshet alafim shana have alma. The world is to exist for 6,000 years. Shnei alafim, arguably the first 2,000 of those 6,000 years, tohu. That is to say, these were years that were of desolate. Okay. Shnei alafim, arguably again the middle 2,000 years, Torah. Right? Those are the years that are the era that is marked by the flourishing of Torah. And then Shnei alafim, the final 2,000 years, Yimot HaMashiach. Okay. As I said, this is a rather well-known statement. I'm sure that I'm not the first one to call to your attention that if indeed we are in the year 5782 to the creation of the world, which is the conventional understanding, so much so that when you get married, that's the era to which your ketubah, your marriage certificate, is inscribed, okay, then of course there are arguably only 218, even less now, 217 years and a month or so left until somehow the world comes to an end. That if indeed it was supposed to last for, it is supposed to last for 6,000 years, then it said just subtract 5,782 from 6,000, and you can figure out when the world is supposed to either come to an end or at least something significant is supposed to change. Exactly how they come to this figure is a curiosity. First of all, it seems to have divided this 6,000 somewhat arbitrarily into three equal eras of exactly 2,000 each. And the interesting thing is that we can, if we want to, we can actually calculate the first 2,000 years. And if indeed that stands up to inquiry, then arguably the balance of it does as well. So I will remind you, since this is something that I recall very distinctly having said on at least two prior occasions in the classes that I've given in Torah in Moshe, that our father Abraham was born in the same year as the state of Israel. Right? State of Israel was created in 1948, of course, of a particular era. And Avraham Avinu was also born in the year 1948 of a different era. He was born in the year 1948 to the creation of the world. And this is an exact number because we can go back through the early chapters of Sefer Bereshit, and we know exactly how old Adam was when Shet was born, and how old Shet was when his eldest child was born, and how old Terach was when Avraham was born. And indeed, it all adds up to the year 1948 to the creation of the world. There is, therefore, a rabbinic tradition that asks, how old was our father Abraham when he discovered God? He was 52 years old. Now, this is a bit of a tautology because it's not clear whether they decided that he was 52 years old because if you add 52 to 1948, you get 2000. And that would be a confirmation of the statement that the era of Torah began in the year 2000. Or whether, in fact, there is independent evidence for Abraham having discovered God at the age of 52, in which case the text we have in front of us from Masechet Sanhedrin is not the source of that identification, but rather a result of it. One way or the other, as I said, one can reasonably estimate the year in which the era of Torah began, if indeed we identify that not with Matan Torah, not with the revelation of the law at Sinai, but rather with Avraham Avinu's purported discovery of God at the age of 52, that if that indeed can be dated to the year 2000, to the creation of the world, then, as I said, it sort of adds a little more credibility to the balance of it. One way or the other, it's in response to statements such as this that the previous slide refers, when it says that the rabbi said that anybody who tries to calculate the end, the kates, the end, tipachatzman, meaning the rabbis frowned on messianic calculations. Okay. That brings us back to the Rambam and to Igeret Teiman. You may remember this from 2 weeks ago. It's just the title page of a particular edition of the Igeret Teiman. And you may recall that I was somewhat amazed that in Tav Shin Yod in 1950, somebody actually thought that an edition of the Igeret Teiman belonged to what they call on the top of the page, Sifriyala Mitlamdim, that it was a decent text for people to read if, in fact, they were teaching themselves Hebrew. Okay. And here is where in Igeret Teiman, the Rambam turns his attention to the fact that apparently at this time in Yemen, in addition to messianic pretenders, in addition to false messiahs, there were people who were not pretending to be the Messiah themselves, but who claimed to be able to calculate when the Messianic era would begin. And he writes to Rabbi Netan El-Fayumi, his correspondent in Yemen, in your letter you have adverted to the computations of the date of the redemption. Right? He's made reference to the fact that there were people who were computing, who were calculating the time of the redemption, that is the arrival of the Messiah and the release of Israel from oppression and the restoration of the lost tribes and everything else that's part and parcel of the Messianic era. And that his correspondent made specific reference to Rabbi Saadia's opinion on the subject. You may remember Saadia Gaon was an outstanding luminary in the early part of the 10th century. He translated the Torah and significant other portions of Tanakh into Arabic and wrote commentaries on many biblical books, wrote the first systematic and methodical work of Jewish philosophy, known in its Hebrew translation as Sefer HaEmunot VaHadeyot. He was the earliest, one of the earliest Hebrew grammarians, a truly outstanding figure. And as we will see shortly, in his commentary on the book of Daniel, right, he offered his own opinion on whether one can calculate the Messianic age. So in response to this, Rambam wrote, towards the end of the second line, first of all, he says, it devolves upon you to know that no human being will ever be able to determine it precisely. Meaning, it's just simply frustrating, right? There is no way that anybody can actually calculate the Messianic age. He knows that because Daniel, the prophet Daniel, already intimated, for the words are shut up and sealed. Okay? Indeed, Rambam says many hypotheses were advanced by scholars, so that Saadia is only one of many scholars who attempted to calculate this, who fancied that they have discovered the date. And he says that indeed scripture even anticipated that people would attempt these calculations. As Daniel himself wrote, even in that same verse, many will run to and fro, and opinions shall be increased. That is to say, Rambam explains that there will be numerous views concerning it. Furthermore, he wrote, we have a divine communication through the medium of the prophets that many persons will calculate the time of the advent of the Messiah, but will fail to ascertain its true date. Indeed, we are cautioned against giving way to doubt and distrust because of these miscalculations. The longer the delay, the more fervently shall you hope, as it is written, and he cites a verse in the book of Habakkuk, and declareth of the end, and doth not lie, v'yafech laketz v'lo yechazev, though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not delay. If this resonates with you, it's because the formulation of the 12th of Maimonides' 13 articles of faith, right, one that many people recite at the end of the Shacharit service, okay, says, "Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleya b'vi'at ha-mashiach," right, but I believe with perfect faith in the eventual coming of the Messiah. But then it adds, "V'af al pi sheyit mahameha," even if he tarries, right? Achakelo b'chol yom sheyavo, I will await him whenever he comes. Or alternatively, it could mean every day I will anticipate his arrival. So the idea that somehow the Messianic age cannot be calculated, but however much it may seem to tarry, we have a reasonable expectation that it will nevertheless happen, okay? This is, as I said, what resonates with this line in the Igeret Teiman. And now he gives an illustration of how there was an earlier redemption of the Jewish people that also people attempted to calculate, and that they were significantly wrong in their calculation. And he says, remember that even the date of the termination of the Egyptian exile, that is to say, Shibud Mitzrayim, right, that we celebrate our redemption from it every year on Pesach, was not precisely known and gave rise to differences of opinion, despite the fact, he says, that its duration was fixed in Scripture. After all, in the Brit Bein HaBetarim, in the covenant that God made with Abraham, he said, Yadoa teda ki ger yeh zaracha b'eretz lo lahem. Know well that your descendants will be strangers in an alien land. Va'avadum v'einu otam. And they will be enslaved and they will be afflicted. Arba me'ot shana, 400 years. Question, of course, was, when did the period of 400 years begin? Pshuto shel mikra, the simple reading of the text, is that the period of enslavement and affliction was to last for 400 years. So some reckon the period of 400 years from the time of Jacob's arrival in Egypt. Others dated it from the beginning of Israel's bondage, which happened 70 years later, while others computed it from the time of the covenant of the pieces, the Brit Ben Habtarim, when this matter was divinely predicted to Abraham. So, at the expiration of 400 years after this event, meaning 400 years after the Brit Ben Habtarim, namely 30 years before the appearance of Moses, okay, that would be 30 years before the real redemption from Egypt, what happened? A band of Israelites left Egypt because they believed that exile had ended for them. Meaning that because they calculated the 400 years to commence with the Brit Ben Habtarim, which apparently was erroneous, and we'll see shortly just why, their 400-year clock ran out 30 years prematurely. But because they were persuaded of the accuracy of their calculation, they decided that the 400 years were over, so they picked themselves up and they left the land of Egypt. But what happened to them? They were subdued and slain by the Egyptians. That is to say, their attempt to leave Egypt 30 years prematurely was unsuccessful. And the lot of the Israelites who remained was consequently aggravated, as we learn from our sages, the teachers of our national traditions, meaning that the remaining 30 years until the Israelites were really redeemed, they suffered more on account of the fact that some of them had made this erroneous attempt to leave prematurely. And he maintains that somehow in the book of Tehillim, King David already alluded to the vanquished Israelites who miscalculated the date of the redemption in a verse referring to Bnei Ephraim. The children of Ephraim were as archers handling the bow that turned back in the day of battle. So this idea somehow that people from the tribe of Ephraim suffered a military setback is related in rabbinic tradition to this attempt by certain Israelites to leave Egypt 30 years too soon. In truth, Rambam said, the period of 400 years did not commence with the Brit Ben Habtarim. Rather, it commenced with the birth of Isaac. After all, it says, Ki ger yihyeh zar'acha be'eretz lo lahem. Your descendants will be enslaved. And at the time of the Brit Ben Habtarim, right, if Abraham indeed at that point in time was 70 years old, okay, he had no descendants yet. Therefore, the conventional interpretation is that the 400 years began at the moment that Abraham had descendants. And since the first moment at which Abraham had a descendant was when at the age of 100, Isaac was born, because the verse says, Ki bi Yitzchak yikare lecha zera, okay? Therefore, the 400-year clock, so to speak, began to tick with the birth of Isaac. Okay? In exile, middle of the paragraph, they would rule, enslave, and maltreat them. This is the implication of this text. The 400 years mentioned in the verse refer to the duration of the exile and not solely to the Egyptian bondage. This fact was misunderstood. That's why there were people, ostensibly from the tribe of Ephraim, who miscalculated it, okay, until the great prophet Moses came, when all of a sudden it was realized that the 400 years dates back precisely to the birth of Isaac. So here I show you what the calculation is, okay? The verse says that your descendants, Zerah, will be strangers in a land not their own. They will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. Now, remember, if the 400-year clock starts ticking with the birth of Isaac, then Isaac is 60 years old when Jacob was born, right? That's an explicit biblical verse. Jacob was 130 years old when he descended to Egypt. That too is an explicit biblical verse. In fact, it's rather curious because the first thing when Pharaoh is introduced to Jacob as the father of Joseph, this remarkable fellow whose ability to interpret dreams saved Egypt from catastrophe, the only thing that Pharaoh can ask Jacob is, how old are you? Now, it seems to be a very unusual thing to ask. Although, of course, I must add that this Pharaoh, if you remember, is pretty much the only character in the Bible we know of to have actually celebrated his birthday. Because you remember that it was on Pharaoh's birthday that Joseph was released from prison. So it could just very well be that this particular Pharaoh had an obsession with birthdays and with ages. In any event, because he asked Jacob, how old are you? And Jacob responded that he is 130 years old. That's how we're able to maintain this calculation. So from the birth of Isaac until the time that Jacob came down to Egypt is 190 years. So 190 years of the 400-year clock had already ticked off by the time that Jacob and his family came down to Egypt. That means that of the 400 years that were spoken of in the Brit Ben Habitarim, there remained only 210 years left for the period in which the Israelites would not only be strangers in a land not their own, but would be enslaved and oppressed. And that figure of 210 leads to yet another rabbinic calculation. We're told slightly before the time that Jacob and his family actually descend to Egypt, that when Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, Lama titra, why are you just simply looking at each other? He said, I heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy us some grain, v'nichye v'lo namot, so that we will live and not die. And the words that he used to tell his sons to go down to Egypt are redu shama. Now, if you know your gematria, resh has a numerical value of 200, dalet is 4, and vav is 6. Add it all up, and redu has a numerical value of 210. As though somehow Jacob knew and was implying to his sons that when they went down to Egypt, which was solely for the purpose of acquiring grain, because ostensibly they did not know at that time that Joseph was still alive, let alone that he was the viceroy of Egypt, and that they would eventually be joining him there, Jacob somehow, either deliberately or totally unconsciously, was telling his children, redu, you have 210 years left on the clock. Now, the funny thing is that at the time of the Exodus from Egypt, this is Exodus chapter 12, that's already after the 10th plague, okay? It says, Umoshav b'nei Yisrael asher yashavu be'eretz Mitzrayim, the amount of time that the children of Israel lived in Egypt, shloshim shana v'arba me'ot shana, was 430 years. Here's where that 30 years that Rambam alluded to previously, the 30 years prior to the actual conclusion of the 400-year clock, as I've been calling it, the one that misled some Israelites into undertaking a premature exodus, okay, is calculated as follows. Abraham arguably was 70 years old at the time of the Brit Ben Habitarim. Okay. He was 100 when Isaac was born, which was 30 years later. So if we started counting the ostensible time of the vision, the 400 years, right, from the Brit Ben Habtarim, rather than from Isaac's birth, that explains how we reached the 400 mark 30 years earlier. And indeed, according to a Talmudic Midrashic tradition, the one to which Maimonides alluded, the children of Ephraim mistakenly thought that the earlier mark signaled their redemption, whereupon they left Egypt to return to the land of Canaan, only to be slain on their way by the Philistines. And this, in fact, is the interpretation of a rather enigmatic verse in the book of Chronicles. that mentions somebody named Zeved and his son Shutelach and Azer and Elad, whom the men of Gath that were born in the land slew, Vaharagum Anshei Gath. Why? Because they came down to take away their cattle. And Ephraim, their father, mourned for many days, and his brethren came to comfort him. So arguably, this is the source of the tradition that identifies these Jews, these Israelites, who undertook this premature exodus as having been from the tribe of Ephraim. And indeed, this gave birth in the Talmud to a rather, not particularly well known, but I wouldn't call it an esoteric tradition, namely the tradition that identifies a pre-messianic figure named Mashiach ben Yosef. Here's the passage in the Talmud that leads into this. Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi Haglili, said, "The dead whom the prophet Yechezkel revived," right? You remember the vision of the dry bones, okay? "Went up to Palestine. They made Aliyah, right? Married wives and begat sons and daughters." Meaning that this wasn't just a vision that the prophet Yechezkel had, but that these were real bones who really were resurrected, and that after the resurrection, they continued to lead what we would call mortal lives. In fact, the Talmud says that a Tana named Rabbi Yehuda ben Betera rose up and said, okay, "Ani mibnei bneihem," I'm actually a descendant of these resurrected people. And not only that, he says, "V'halalu tfilin sheheniach li abi abba mehem." And he even showed, as it were, his tfilim and said that these tfilim had belonged originally to one of these resurrected people. Okay. The Talmud continues and it asks, "Umaninu metim shechayayechezkel." Who were these people whose bones were brought back to life by the prophet? Amar Rav, right? The first generation Amora Rav replied, "Elu bnei Ephraim shemanu laketz v'ta'u." They were the Ephraimites who counted the years to the end of Shibud Mitzrayim, to the end of the Egyptian bondage, but were mistaken. And indeed, he quotes as his proof the verse in Divrei Hayamim that we saw just a moment ago, right? And the sons of Ephraim, Shutelach and Bered and Tachat and Elada, etc. And it says of them, right? "V'ktiv v'haragum anshei Gath hanoladim ba'aretz," they were slain by the people of Gath. "V'yitabel Ephraim avihem yamim rabim," and they were mourned by their father Ephraim, ostensibly a reference to the historical Ephraim, the son of Yosef, not to a descendant of his, right? And this is what we find in the Gemara again in Masechet Sukkah, okay? The reference to and again in the Midrash in Breshit Rabbah, which also dates from the Tannaitic period, references to a Mashiach ben Yosef. And we know two things about this Mashiach ben Yosef, the Talmud tells us. One is sheneharag, that he will be slain. And the other is sheyavot chila l'mashiach ben David. That somehow the ultimate eventual arrival of the real Mashiach, the Mashiach ben David, right? Prior to his arrival, there will be a messianic-like figure, not a descendant of David from the tribe of Judah, but a descendant of Ephraim, right? A descendant of Yosef from the tribe of Ephraim, and that We don't know any more of the details. At least there are no details supplied in any of these early sources, although there is considerable speculation in later medieval sources, right? But that somehow he will be unsuccessful. He will even die in his attempt, but that this is the precursor to the arrival of the, I hate to call him true Mashiach, implying that the Mashiach ben Yosef, if indeed there is to be such a Mashiach, is a false Messiah. There's no suggestion that he is a false Messiah. There's rather the suggestion that he is a pre-Messianic figure, not per se a false Messianic figure. Okay. Rambam now continues, and he says that if so much uncertainty prevailed in regard to the day of the emancipation from Egyptian bondage, the term of which is fixed in the Torah, then kal vachomer, how much more would it be the case in respect to the date of the final redemption, right? The prolonged and protracted duration of which appalled and dismayed our inspired seers, so that one of them was moved to exclaim, "Will thou be angry with us forever? Will thou draw out thine anger to all generations?" Meaning, at some point, right, the length of the period of exile, a period during which Jews, if not being actually enslaved and oppressed, were certainly subjugated and persecuted, right, lent people to really speculate on whether this was interminable, whether it would never end, or whether there was a way to figure out when, in fact, it might conclude. The prophet Isaiah, too, alluding to the long drawn out exile, declared, "They shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the dungeon. They'll be shut up in prison. After many days, they shall be released." But he doesn't say how many days. Inasmuch as Daniel proclaimed the matter a deep secret, we saw that text just a while ago, our sages have interdicted the calculation of time. That's the phrase we saw, tipach atzmam shel mechashvei kitzim, or the reckoning of the period of the advent of the Messiah. Why? Because the masses might be mystified and bewildered should the Messiah fail to appear as forecast. Meaning, why did the rabbis care whether somebody would offer some sort of a calculation? The answer is that in the event that people put their trust in this calculation, and the calculation almost invariably would fail to be realized, then rather than just saying, "Oh, he didn't know how to calculate it properly," there were people whose conclusion might be, there is no such thing. There'll never be an end to the suffering. So in order to prevent that from happening, the rabbis just simply said, it's much better. Let's just not calculate. The rabbis invoke God to frustrate and destroy those who seek to determine the advent of the Messiah, again, because the masses might be mystified and bewildered should the Messiah fail to appear as forecast. The rabbis invoke God to frustrate and destroy those who seek to determine precisely the advent of the Messianic era, because they are a stumbling block to the people, and that is why they uttered the imprecation, which we saw in the opening slide, tipach atzman shel mechashvei kitzim, translated roughly as, "May the calculators of final redemption come to grief." But you remember in the opening slide that Maimonides made specific reference to some calculation of the Messianic era that was made not just by, somebody with an abacus, right, but was made by a notable figure, no less an authority than Sa'adya Gaon, who was probably during the 10th and 11th and early part of the 12th centuries held in the same regard as Maimonides was held subsequently. And Rabbi Sa'adya Gaon, as I said again, we'll see shortly now in his commentary on the book of Daniel, did in fact propose just such a calculation. So says Rambam, as for Rabbi Saadia's messianic calculations, there are extenuating circumstances for them, though he knew they were disallowed. Meaning, if the rabbis, you know, said no calculations, then how could Saadia Gaon of all people, right, go against the rabbis? So the first thing that Maimonides wants us to know is that there were extenuating circumstances. Why? He explains. For the Jews of his time were perplexed and misguided. The divine religion might well nigh have disappeared had he not encouraged the pusillanimous and diffuse, disseminated and propagated by word of mouth and pen, a knowledge of its underlying principles. The Talmud has a biblical verse that it uses in contexts such as these. It says, "Et la'asot la'shem heferu toratecha," that somehow one can act in contravention of the law if there is in fact a good reason. Somehow, on occasion, the end will justify the means. So, without going into detail, Rambam either knew what the details were, or even if he did not know the details, his trust in Saadia Gaon was such that he just simply presumed that there had to be extenuating circumstances. And he implies that Saadia Gaon offered this messianic calculation simply because people were, as we saw previously, people were despairing of ever seeing redemption or salvation. He continues, and he said in the second paragraph here, he believed that his Saadia, in all earnestness, that by means of the messianic calculations, he would inspire the masses with hope for the truth. Indeed, Rambam says, verily, all his deeds were for the sake of heaven. Consequently, in view of the probity of his motives, and since indeed we're assuming that he didn't do this as a lawbreaker, but he did it for a valid purpose, right? The purpose which we have disclosed, one must not decry him for his messianic computations. Meaning, don't point a finger at him and say, shame on Saadia, he violated the Talmudic proscription against messianic calculations. Occasionally, Maimonides seems to say, they should be allowed. Keep this in mind, because something is going to happen shortly. If you can already connect the dots, well, I don't want to give it away completely, but if you go dot, dot, dot from Saadia Gaon in the 10th century to Maimonides in the 12th century, you might have already figured out where we're heading. But as I said, don't want to give it all away. Here is just an excerpt from Saadia Gaon's commentary on the Book of Daniel, showing the basis for the messianic calculation that he offered. Here we have a verse, a couple of consecutive verses in the 12th chapter of the Book of Daniel, in which there are references to periods of time. Okay, it says, "Me'et husar hatamid," from the time that the Korban Tamid, the burnt offering, was taken away, v'latet shikutz shomeim, and a detestable thing, arguably a statue or an idol, right, was erected. I just think Hanukkah, right? Elef matayim v'tishim. 1,290. Now, the English translation says days because it says yamim, right? But remember that in biblical Hebrew, the word yom, more often than not in poetic context, but arguably, conceivably, even in a prose context, can mean a year rather than a day. In any event, here we have the figure of 1,290. Then he continues in verse 12, and he says, "Ashrei hamechakeh v'yagi'a," right? Happy is he who has patience and waits, liyamim 1335. Right? 1,335. Okay? So you have 1290 and 1335. And then, what is this all about? Verse 13, va'ata lech laketz, right? Go until the end, v'tanuach, and you will rest, v'tamod l'gor alcha laketz hayamin, and you will receive your lot or your portion, when? At the end of days. So here at least is some sort of an insinuation that somehow the end of days is connected to one or another of two figures, one of which is 1290 and the other is 1335. Now, interesting thing, as I note on the bottom, is that Sa'adya Gaon actually entitled this commentary to the book of Daniel, the book of kingdoms and visions, concerning what will come to pass after 1386 years. So you see again that even in the title that he gave to his commentary on the book of Daniel, Sa'adya was already indulging in messianic calculations. And I just simply, it's a lengthy commentary, and it isn't, in fact, it isn't really even accessible. I don't think it's available in an English translation. So it now devolves upon us to endeavor to find out by which interpretation the words in question will mean 1335 years. I have therefore investigated the matter and found that if we take the word zmanim, okay, because elsewhere in the book of Daniel, he talks about zman, zmanim. He talks about the Aramaic words idan and idanim, a time, a period of time, several periods of time. If we take the word zmanim to refer to the periods of Israel's independence, okay, it will fitly result that the time which is to pass before our final redemption will equal 1.5 the amount of these periods. Okay, for we know that Israel's independence lasted altogether 890 years. How does he know that? 480 years elapsed prior to the erection of the first temple, meaning, according to the book of Kings, when King Solomon built the first temple, it actually says explicitly that the temple was built 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt. So arguably, in those 480 years, the people of Israel were independent. Then the first temple itself stood for 410 years, right? Obviously, the destruction of first temple marks the end of Israel independence. So if you add 480 and 410, then arguably from the Exodus from Egypt until the destruction of the first temple, the era of Jewish independence lasted for 890 years. So if 890 years is X, and you want to know what is 1.5 times X, then 1.5 times X is 890 plus 445, and that gives you 1335. So basically what Sa'adya Gaon was doing was giving us some insight into the book of Daniel, and claiming that when Daniel spoke about 1335 years, he was giving us a clue that somehow, if we wanted to calculate the arrival of the Messiah, the ultimate redemption, we had to take into consideration prior redemptions and prior eras of independence. Here we come to the other shoe falls, the one I alluded to a moment ago when I said if you connected the dots. And that is, Rambam writes that even though the precise date of the Messianic advent cannot be known, but, he says, I am in possession of an extraordinary tradition which I received from my father, who in turn received it from his father, going back to our early ancestors who were exiled from Jerusalem and who are mentioned by the prophet Ovadia, Begalut Yerushalayim Asher Bisfarad. According to this tradition, meaning, in spite of the fact that the Talmud says it's not a good idea to calculate the end, in spite of the fact that Sa'adya Gaon, on account of extenuating circumstances, offered a calculation and was wrong, right? Here is Rambam, 200 years after Saadia Gaon, maybe 250 years even after Saadia Gaon, doing it again, offering a messianic calculation, which he maintains is not his own originally, but it's part of an ancestral tradition that arguably goes back to the earliest Jewish settlers in Spain, who were themselves exiled from Jerusalem at the time of the destruction of the first temple. According to this tradition, on the fifth line, there is a covert indication in the prediction of Bilaam to the future restoration of prophecy in Israel. And arguably, the restoration of prophecy is a co-eval, right? It will occur at the same time, will be contemporary with the advent of the Messiah. And what is that tradition? Incidentally, it may be stated that there are other verses in the Torah that contain cryptic allusions in addition to this simple meaning. For example, we saw this. The word redu in the remark of Jacob to his sons, redu shama, has a numerical value of 210 and contained a hint to the length of Israel's stay in Egypt. Likewise, when Moses said to the children of Israel, ki tolid banim uvnei banim, v'noshantem ba'aretz, that's this week's Torah reading, right? It embodies a reference to the duration of Israel's stay in the land of Israel, because the numerical value of the word v'noshantem, 840 years. Okay, so A, Maimonides has a family tradition. B, it's based upon a biblical verse that is assumed to have, in addition to its simple meaning, a gematria, meaning a numerical meaning. And here it is. Bilaam's prophecy, okay? After the lapse of time, one will tell Jacob and Israel what God hath wrought. Ma pa'al el. If you recognize the words, what hath God wrought? Of course, those are arguably the first words that Alexander Graham Bell spoke into the first ever telephone. Okay? And it contains a veiled allusion to the date of the restoration of prophecy in Israel. The statement means that after the lapse of an interval equal to the time that passed from creation to the time of Bilaam, then seers, prophets, will again tell Israel what God hath wrought. Now, we know that the Exodus from Egypt was in the year 2448 to the creation of the world. The incident involving Bilaam was 37 years later. Hence, it occurred in the year 2485. And if then prophecy was going to be restored 2485 years after Bilaam's prophecy, then it would be restored in the year 4976. Okay? The year 4976 to the creation of the world, you may remember just a couple of weeks ago, I told you that the key number for converting years to creation into years to the common era is 240. Okay? So the year 4976 to the creation of the world is the year 1216 of the Common Era. That means that Maimonides, who died in the year 1204, right, at the age of only 70, okay, was sharing with his audience a calculation that would have had the Messiah coming within only 20 years or so of the time that he was writing to them. So I said again, despite the Talmud's warning that the bones of those who calculate the end will be pulverized, in spite of the fact that great people prior to Maimonides, like Saadia Gaon, made similar attempts, knowing that they were going to be unsuccessful, right? Maimonides, probably for the same reasons that he imputes to Saadia Gaon, namely that he saw that the people in Yemen were despairing, that they thought that if one cannot calculate this at all, then maybe there is no Messiah to be calculated. So rather than have them, as it were, discard their belief in the Messiah on account of their inability to calculate the Messianic era, Maimonides shared with his correspondent what he maintains was a family tradition that would have had the Messianic era beginning with only a short amount of time from his own death. This is the conclusion that he writes, and it's pretty much self-explanatory. I have a quick look at you don't really seem to have either inspired anybody or provoked anybody. What do we have here? Okay. Did Rambam call his book Guide to the Perplexed to indicate? No. This is not the Guide to the Perplexed. This is the letter to the Jews of Yemen. He called his book The Guide to the Perplexed because he was writing on behalf of a student of his who was actually exhibiting some perplexity regarding certain philosophical notions. Okay. Jewish exiles went to Spain after the First Temple. Well, the concluding verses in the book of Ovadia mention two things. They mention this, they talk about Galut Hachel Hazeh Asher Knaanim Ad Tzorfat, the Galut Yerushalayim Asher Bisfarad. So the word Tzorfat, which conventionally is France, and Sfarad, which is Spain, happened to appear in the biblical book of Ovadia. You asked me personally, I'll tell you that this there was another Tzorfat. If you remember, the prophet Elisha spent time in the home of a woman in Tzorfat, and it's not because he went to France. It's because there was a place called Tzorfat that was north of the land of Israel in the kingdom of the Phoenicians. So if there was a Tzorfat that was closer to the land of Israel, there's no reason not to assume that there was a place closer to the land of Israel that was called Sepharad. So the people who were exiled either by the Assyrians or by the Babylonians in the First Temple era probably were not exiled all the way to Europe. Nonetheless, in the Middle Ages, it became habitual for the Jews of Spain to kind of, you know, to them it was a sign of pride, because they were able to say that they weren't just ordinary Judeans who were exiled, at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple like everybody else was, but that they were special Judeans, right? Members, arguably, of even the royal family who were exiled at the time of the destruction of the First Temple. So it's an unsupported legend. Exile means leaving your homeland. How can the years before Jacob be called the years of exile? They're not called years of exile. The word galut is not used there. The words that are used there are eretz lo lahem, a land that was not theirs. So the truth of the matter is that when Isaac himself, on account of a famine, went and spent time in the land of the Philistines, that could already be considered an eretz lo lahem. Or when Jacob went and spent time with his uncle Laban in Aramea, that too could be considered an eretz lo lahem. So again, there's a difference between exile, right, which is, I don't know if it's as much a state of mind as it is a political state. The term that's in use there is rather just simply eretz lo lahem, a land that isn't yours. I don't know anything about Sfarad in Paul. I don't know who Paul is. Is that like Paul from Peter, Paul, and Mary, or is that Paul from St. Paul? Someone? Anyone? Don't know. Okay. 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 Everybody, very welcome, particularly Sandy and Kenny. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Bye. By the way, I can't just what to come away at the beginning. You know, how many years we're away from 7,000? You're giving the very firm interpretation. If we assume the second Beit HaMikdash, was stood for 600 years, as all historians do, and the first temple was stored in 586, we have a missing 150 years. So we're really in the year, as you know, I'm sure, we're really in the year like 5940 by now. So,
well, actually, it's 165. It's 165 years,
right?
And that I'm sure you know is the subject of a rather out of the box essay by the late Rabbi Shimon Schwab.
Correct. Yes, that's a great essay. You want to briefly summarize the essay? Or you want me to?
Well, basically, Rabbi Schwab says that the problem that Rabbi Kelman was alluding to is that according to rabbinic literature, the Second Temple stood for only 420 years. Now, remember, we saw today that the first temple stood for 410 years. Now, the prophet Nahum says, Gadol yihyeh kvod habayit hazeh ha'acharon min harishon. He said that the glory of the second temple would be greater than that of the first temple. So all that means is that if the first temple stood for 410 years, then the second temple has to stand longer than the first temple. So arguably 420 is simply a number that was chosen because it's more than 410. But there's a little more to it than that. The problem is, of course, that if the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE, and it was rebuilt 70 years later under Darius, okay, in 516, and it was destroyed by the Romans in the year 68 of the Common Era. By the way, it was destroyed in 68 of the Common Era, not in the year 70. Okay, 70 is a very popular conventional mistake. Okay, then the second temple did not stand for only 420 years. It stood for 585 years. So arguably, rabbinic chronology is in error of 165 years. So there are two questions to address to that. One is, how could they have made such a mistake? Right? 165 years isn't loose change, right? 165 years is a big slice of 585. How do you misplace them? Okay. So there are two answers. Okay. One answer is an apologetic answer. And that is that the rabbis didn't really know how long the temple stood under Persian rule. Remember that the second temple.
I'm waiting for this to be over.
The second temple, was not counted. Remember that Rambam didn't count it as a period of Jewish independence. Why? Because at no point during the second temple, except arguably maybe during the time of the Hasmoneans, were the Jews self-governing completely. Okay, they were first under the domination of the Persians. Then they came under the domination of the Greeks and eventually under the domination of the Romans. When the Greeks conquered the land of Israel from the Persians, one of the things that happened that changed in Jewish life was something we've referred to previously called Minyan Hashtarot, the Seleucid era. It began in the year 311 BCE. So when the temple was destroyed in the year 68 of the Common Era, everybody could add 311 and 68, and everybody knew that the temple, under the Greeks, the temple stood for 380 years. What they didn't know was exactly how many years the temple had stood under the Persians before the Greeks came. And here, one answer is, they made a mistake. How could they make a mistake? Because if you remember your Pirkei Avot, okay, in the first chapter of Pirkei Avot, we meet a character who is called Shimon HaTzadik, right? Simon the Righteous, and he's identified as Mishiarei HaKnesset HaGedola, that he was a member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. Okay? The Anshei Knesset HaGedola was a synod that was convened in the earliest years of the Second Temple by Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? We also have a Talmudic legend that tells us that somebody named Shimon HaTzadik met Alexander the Great. And because he told Alexander the Great, he forecast that Alexander the Great was going to become the king of Macedonia, Alexander rewarded him by sparing the province of Judea. So if the Shimon HaTzadik who met Alexander the Great was one and the same with the Shimon HaTzadik who had been a member of the original synod of 120 members that was convened by Ezra, then how much time could pass from the beginning of the Second Temple period until the Greeks came? So the answer was 40, which is a typological number for a generation. So since they assumed that the Persians had ruled over the land of Israel for only one generation before the Greeks replaced them, that's how they calculated the length of the Second Temple to be only 420 years. What Rabbi Schwab did, Rabbi Schwab came along and said, the rabbis are too smart to have made a mistake like that. They didn't mistake 165 years. They deliberately swept 165 years under the carpet, meaning they withdrew 165 years from circulation. Why? Because, as we've seen, since every calculation of the Messianic era incorporates data from the duration of the first and second temples, right? If they disguised the actual duration of the second temple, they were basically ensuring that nobody would ever be able to calculate the Messianic era correctly. And therefore, as Rabbi Kalman alluded, according to Rabbi Schwab, right, this it would not be the year 5,782. It might actually be 165 years later than that, which means that if we go back to the very first slide, and if indeed the year 6,000 to the creation of the world is supposed to mark some sort of apocalyptic change, then we are 165 years closer to the apocalypse than we might actually imagine. Now, whether if indeed we could be convinced that that was true, whether that would inspire us to greater faith and greater belief and greater observance, or whether it would somehow create the opposite, that's the stuff of which Rambam Zigeret Teiman is made. So there we have it.
Okay, and we won't discuss the Ramban's view in his debate with public Christianity, how he interpreted that Gemara. We'll leave that for another time, but basically the Ramban rejected that Gemara out of hand. But that's a whole other scholarly debate for other times. Okay, nice to see everybody. Tonight, Rabbi Stephen Gottman will be giving our Parsha Shir. He is the on the official title of Brech in the Beit Midrash Zichron Dov here in Toronto, learning as a very interesting fellow. And I invite everybody at 8:30 tomorrow morning, 9:35, my sitter class continues. We're actually starting Ashrei tomorrow. So that's everybody's welcome. And then Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15, continuing on Sefer Yirmiyahu, his series. And, we look forward to learning with you next week, future weeks, all the time. As I say, please invite a friend to join us. We'll in the next week or so, we're putting together details for quote-unquote our Elul Zman, you know, series, which, please God, will begin Sunday, August the 28th. And okay, everybody, look forward to learning with you soon. And have a wonderful day.
Are you doing the shiur tomorrow?
I'm giving my shiur tomorrow. Yeah, that's it. 9:35 on Ashrei. Yeah. We finished Yehi Chavod last week. We'll start Ashrei this week. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is, you know, Ashrei is a, I'm sorry?
See you then.
Okay, good. Okay. Thank you. All right, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Enjoy the, school starts in less than 4 weeks. I don't know. Is the summer coming to an end? The days are getting shorter, but enjoy the summer. Okay. All right. Be well, everybody.